you guys. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, like we've done for the last 36 years, we run the technical net. The technical net is a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment in general. How does that radio signal propagate? How do I get the best performance out of my transmitter, my receiver, my antenna, my transmission line, my antenna tuner? What's that really doing? Questions like that. The TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section is people sign in with questions or comments with reference to radio in general. That's followed by the second section, which we call the science and physics section, run by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. And then that's followed by the third section, which is run by Paul, WS2N, the space report, in which he tells us what NASA is doing and then all the other space agencies, what they're doing. There's no such thing as a dumb question on the TechNet, so don't worry about that. You can ask dumb questions. From our point of view, the dumb question is the one most deserving of an answer. Let me drop. As I said before, that's the one, the dumb question is the one that has the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he wants. He might not even be able to express his question as well. He doesn't have the vocabulary yet. So we don't chastise people for doing that. We almost welcome them, if you know what I mean. This TechNet began in 1982 in September. So that was, going on 16 years ago, 35 and a half years ago. This is TechNet number 1,700. You'll be hearing Space Report tonight of Space Report number 300 and Science and Physics Report from Dr. Roy number 30. So, this is not a super, what's the word for it now? We don't run this net with real tight rules where every single question must go through the net control operator. We don't insist on that. We also don't use that silly question everybody has to ask in net. Is there any emergency traffic? There never is, but they ask that question anyhow, just by force of habit or tradition of some kind. So, people who do have a question or a comment, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, because I'm so non-forgetful, please give me your name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Try to remember to wait for the four beeps in between each transmission, otherwise we time out the machine. So, questions and answers. Questions and comments, give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. K2RAW listening.
Comment, Dick. M2EO.
Okay, Rich recognized. Anyone else?
K2TGW, Les, yes.
We got you, Les. So far we got Rich and Les. Anyone else?
Kilo Echo 2, Kilo Bravo, Frank, yes.
Well done, we got you, Frank. So we got Rich, Les, and Frank. Anyone else with questions or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. One last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we got more than enough to get going. First person who signed, it was Rich and 2EO with a comment. Go ahead with your comment, Rich. K2RAW listening.
Okay, Dick and 2EO. I just wanted to give a little critique on Ubuntu Linux. I'm running it. Barry Sonnenor installed it for me because I was having a lot of trouble. It's a good system. It's very, very stable. You use a program called WINE. W-I-N-E is an acronym. That allows you to load Microsoft programs into Linux. It's a lot faster than Microsoft. It loads much faster. And there was no registry. That's the main thing. Microsoft, years ago, started with a registry, and they're stuck with it. And that's why you need things to clean out the registry, clean corrupted. Linux has no registry. The government uses Linux. So, just want to let you know, it's a good system. Don't ignore it. Back to that, and to we own.
That sounds like good news, Rich. I know you were having some trouble making your computer behave. So you like Linux, Ubuntu, and Wine. Sounds like a success story. Let's hope it keeps working for you. Les was the next guy who signed in, K2TGW. Now, Les will discuss anything except antennas. That's a joke. Go right ahead, Les. You got it, K2IW.
Thank you, Dick. It is an antenna question, but not as such. I saw an advertisement, and I know it's bogus, but maybe someone can clue me in, because part of it is what confused me. It's called a Skywire TV. It's an antenna that tells you you can get any signal that you could possibly reach. And then further down in the advertisement, it mentioned all TV signals are now unencoded. I don't think that's correct. I happen to have DirecTV, one of those things on the roof, but I'm sure that signal is encoded, and I can't believe that all signals now are unencoded. K2TGW, back to them.
When it comes to television reception, Les, people do it by cable TV, by satellite TV, various ways to do it over the internet. But by government, by FCC command, they must also transmit over-the-air television broadcast. The over-the-air television broadcast is not encoded. Yes, it's in the digital mode, the 8VSB digital mode, which some people might think is a kind of encoding, but every single channel is using the exact same technique. And so almost all the television sets you buy these days must have a built-in converter which can listen to an over-the-air television signal. So when you connect an antenna, an outside antenna, to that modern-day television set with digital reception capability, you will get over-the-air television reception, and you will get all the channels unencoded that are available in your area. But now, here's the catch. Let me drop them. If I lived, let me pick a number, 15 or 20 miles from New York City and had clear line of sight to the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center, then a relatively simple antenna, a printed circuit antenna, connected to that television set will get me those signals. Out here where I am in Huntington, 30 miles from New York City, from the top of my tower, I get beautiful over-the-air television reception from New York, Connecticut, Maryland, New Jersey, and so on. However, if I had low land in the valley and I had to look through the trees, and most of those signals are on UHF channels of around 500 and 600 megacycles, out here I would get very few channels. So depending on the lay of the land where you live, that antenna will or will not give you all of those over-the-air channels. Let me drop. If I count all of the so-called channels, in other words, the way the channels are dedicated over the air, there's a 2-1 and a 2-2. There's a 4-1, 4-2, 4-3, 4-4, 5-1, 5-2. If I consider each one of those dash numbers as a separate channel, they are a separate programming piece of material, then altogether I've got 30 or 40 channels altogether that I can receive. So there's a lot of over-the-air broadcast if you've got a good arrangement. If you're willing to put up a more serious antenna, as Joe W2RYY has done, where on a short tower on the top of the roof of his house, he has a somewhat fringe area television, aerial, with a rotator. And when it comes to over-the-air reception, if you're a serious watcher, a rotator is required. Let me drop. In the old days, we used to have a rotator in order to peak the signal on the Empire State Building when you're aiming to the west, or to peak it on Hartford if you're going to pick up a television signal from the north. So that's the reason you used a rotator in the old days. Even if you want nothing but New York City reception, and if you want over-the-air reception, and for a person like you and I, ham radio operators, we appreciate the free television reception over the air, the traditional way. I would recommend you put on a rotator. The reason for that is one of the crazy characteristics of over-the-air broadcast, the so-called 8VSB, 8-vestigial sideband mode of transmission, is it's very vulnerable to multipath. If there's a strong multipath signal bouncing off that water tower that's in your town, and now your television aerial is getting a signal directly from Empire and also the bounce, and the two are, one is delayed from the other. Let me drop this. All those individual digitally encoded bits of that television signal on the 8VSB format, they now overlap each other. They call that inter-symbol distortion, and the television set will give you a message across the screen saying weak signal. It isn't because the signal is weak. It's because there's multipath in there, and the digital converter cannot tolerate that inter-symbol distortion. It can't figure out what the hell's going on, so it calls it a weak signal. It's not an automatic gain control circuit that is operating on your digital television receiver. It is a bit error rate. If it's trying to demodulate the signal and it's getting one bit of error per million bits, that's a low bit error rate, and it thinks it's a strong signal. And when it's getting a lot of inter-symbol distortion because of multipath, it's getting a large error rate, and it calls that a weak signal, as if there was noise in there. So it's not noise. So therefore, when you've got a rotator on that antenna, and every television aerial you and I can buy, let me drop it, is trying to cover almost an octave of frequencies. And to make a high-gain, Yagi-like antenna cover an octave, you can't do that. If you plot the real gain versus frequency, if you had the right equipment to do that, you would find a very bumpy curve. So when you, this is now signal strength reception versus azimuth. So with that rotator, you're able to carefully rotate the antenna, not just to peak the signal from Empire, but to take that reflection off the water tower and stuff it in one of those nulls that's in that antenna pattern. And therefore, you'll get beautiful reception. So anybody who does serious over-the-air reception, stand by a minute. You carefully position the azimuth of the antenna so that the null of that falls on that water tower, then you will get clean reception. So over-the-air reception, if you're not very close to New York City, you really should have a rotator, in my opinion. Not everybody's going to agree with that, but Roy has a rotator. I mean, Joe, W-E-2-R-Y-Y, has a rotator, and that allows him to get some real nice DX. So there's a lot of channels available to you, Les. And now, that very simple antenna that they're advertising, they make it sound like it's going to do magic. It's a very low-gain antenna. If you bounce it high enough up with good line of sight to New York City, yes, you'll get a lot of channels. If you live very close to New York City, you get a lot of channels. But if you're out in Huntington, where I am, you're going to need more antenna than that, in my opinion, because UHF is going to have its troubles getting through all those trees. That's some of the information I think you're looking for, Les. K2TGW. Nice hearing from you. You haven't signed in enough lately. I looked at the big book, and it's been a long time since you signed in, Les. K2TGW. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2TGW in the TechNet. Well, I listen quite a bit, but I'm not always home on Sundays. When you have grandchildren, which I'm sure, or things like that, you don't always have a lot of time on your own. What you told me about the Skywire, I was sure was bogus. Their advertising is just trying to convince you to buy something. I live near the water, near JFK Airport, and the first floor is literally sea level. So if I'm on the second floor, I'm up 20 feet, so I'm 20 feet over sea level. I do have a TV up here with rabbit ears, a modern set of rabbit ears.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This to be too good to be true, usually is. I understand what you're telling me. I can rotate that antenna, and it's rotate by human, and some channels do come in a little better, and you're right, no signal or weak signal is what it do tell me. But, okay, understand, you've enlightened me all that I needed to be enlightened. Thank you, Dick. K2 TGW will be clear.
Les, well, you have a nice line of sight location on the water. And from the top of your house, you probably have a clean signal to Empire State Building and the new World Trade Center. If you did make the investment of putting a moderate performance television aerial, and whether or not it says it's rated for digital reception, that's just advertising. A UHF television aerial on a rotator on the roof of your house with a cable coming into the house, you might be very pleasantly surprised as to how many channels you can get from Upper Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, New Jersey, Maryland, and maybe even Connecticut. You might be very pleasantly surprised. There might be 30 or 40 channels there, some of which might not be the same service as you got from your cable TV system, and you don't have to pay for it. The price is right. It's free of charge. So give that some thought. Back to you for any final on that. I'll make sure you wait for the four beeps, Les. T2TGW, T2LIW. Give it a try.
Oh, I doubt I'm going to be able to give it something too much high. I've got, eight or nine antennas sitting on top of my house in one way or another. And my wife says, not that it bothers her because she will defend me when people complain about it, but enough is enough. I don't watch that much television that I need to get too much more involved in it. I have my few channels that I do like. The History Channel, the Discovery Channel, things like something where I can learn something, not someplace where I watch a couple of people fight each other over the head. But thanks for the help, and I will keep it in mind. K2TGW says 7-3.
With all those aerials that are on your roof right now, Les, and though it sounds crazy, as an experiment someday, and come back to us and report what you find, take each one of those antennas with the right kind of a coaxial adapter and plug it into your television receiver. Take each one of those antennas, even though they're ham radio antennas and VHF 2-meter and 432 antennas and whatever, take each one of those, plug it into your television set and see what you get. I think you're going to be very pleasantly surprised. A yucky old antenna could be a bent up piece of coat hanger wire at a reasonable altitude with a cable going to it on the roof of the house. Will give you over-the-air television reception. And so those aerials you get up there right now are a lot more than a piece of coat hanger wire, if you know what I mean. You see what I'm saying here? Even though the antenna, the label on the antenna says it's not made for UHF television reception, you're going to be pleasantly surprised on some of those antennas if you give it a try. Back to you on that, Les. I hope we hear from you on that one. K2TGW, K2IW, wait for the beeps.
K2TGW. I do have a 2-meter, 440 halo. Maybe we could try that. And I have a 6-meter halo. Well, maybe we could futz around with them and see what happens. But it'll have to wait till after the summer. It's golf season, so we all have our priorities, Dick.
Okay. And even if some of those antennas are multi-band, you know, 2-meter, 440, and Yagis and whatever, HF antennas, try each one of them. You're going to be pleasantly surprised as to how many television aerial and television signals you get. The nice thing about digital television, it's either there or it's not there. If it's there, it's a snow-free picture with occasionally some fades and an airplane flies over. In the old days, a weak signal would give you snow. You don't get snow on digital television. You either get a picture or nothing. So I hope you get a chance to give that a try after the golf season. Or maybe someday when it's raining and you can't do the golf. Okay. KE2, Kilo Bravo, I think it is. Frank, go right ahead, Frank. K2LIW, my name is Dick. Wait for the beeps.
Yeah, hi. This is Kilo Echo 2, Kilo Bravo. My name is Frank, and I'm located in Teaneck, New Jersey. I have a question about grounding, lightning, for lightning protection particularly. I have a shack that's on the second floor of the house. I operate both HF and VHF. The HF is limited to 100 watts. The VHF is normally 5 watts, but I have a 25-watt amplifier. In any case, currently I have a 2-meter Ringo Ranger ARX-2B on the side of the house up at the attic. It's about 40 feet above ground level, and it has a grounded mast. It uses EMT tubing as the mast. and the ground runs, number 4 AWG cable runs down to a ground rod directly below the antenna, which is also bonded to the electrical service as per code. Now, I also have my HF antenna, which is just a dipole. That also comes into the same point at the ground rod. As far as protection goes, I have an alpha-delta protector on the HF antenna at the ground rod, and then that coax runs back up to my shack on the outside of the house. I'm going to do the same thing with the 2-meter antenna. Run it down to the ground rod, which is actually my single-point ground, through a protector and then back up to the shack. But my question is whether or not that protected coax is now also susceptible to lightning strike, to either E-field or H-field induced in that cable after the protection device, which I don't know what happened there. I guess I timed out. And the question is whether I need additional protection other than a coax shield for a cable running about 20 feet from the protector up to my shack.
Frank, by my standards, you are a belt and suspenders man. Your amount of lightning protection of your antennas and your installation is better than 98% of all the ham radio operators we've ever talked to. You're way ahead of the game. Now, when it comes to lightning protection, no matter what you do, nothing is perfect. If your system with all the best lightning arresters in the world took a direct hit, there is a chance you're going to get some damage to the cable and maybe even some damage to the front-end transistor of the rig. The word grounding, let me drop it. The three reasons we set up grounding. The first and the most important one is we ground our equipment in order to give it human protection from electrocution. If the grounding system is working correctly, that's the third prong of all of your plugs in the wall, all the chassis of your equipment, they're all traceable to Earth. So therefore, there's nothing that can go wrong with a transformer or the wiring, so if the chassis becomes hot and you touch the chassis and touch a radiator, and you light up, if you know what I mean. So human protection is the first reason we use grounding. The second reason we use grounding is for lightning protection. And the third reason for using grounding is that certain kinds of antennas, very few of them compared to what people believe, work better when portions of the system are RF grounded. But that's not your case. Not to worry. So with the amount of lightning protection you've got, you're way ahead of the game. We all think that that piece of shiny aluminum up in the air, in our eye, it looks like an attractor for lightning. And you think lightning is going to say, aha, there's Frank's house. And boy, that's a juicy piece of metal. That's the one I'm going to hit. So let me drop. When it comes to taking a good hard look at the stuff in your neighborhood, there may be trees that are higher. There may be other buildings that are higher. There may be other metal structures that are higher. In my particular neighborhood, the tallest thing around is my 100-foot tower, which is well-grounded. So I'm the local lightning arrester for all the houses, probably at least one block in almost every direction. So lightning is most likely going to hit the highest object first. And I think my tower, in the 40 years I've lived here, I think it was struck once. And I could tell by the fact that the difference between the flash and the sound was instantaneous, so I knew that it hit extremely close. And I did suffer some damage from other electrical appliances in the house. My computer modem needed replacement, for instance, and the television set had some damage to it. But the amount of lightning protection that you've just described is about as far as anybody normally goes. If you want to go further, let me think of the name of the company now. It's a company in Nevada that makes lightning arresters, Polyphase. Polyphase has a manual. And you could also, there's various places where you can Google this information, but Polyphase has a manual that describes all kinds of lightning techniques, lightning grounding techniques for both commercial installations as well as domestic installations. Let me drop. So that Polyphaser lightning protection manual, I think I bought it a whole lot of years ago, and I think it was like $10. It was a very good buy. It gives you a lot of good information. A typical lightning strike, by the way, is not just one strike. After that leader stroke finds ground, the lightning bolt itself, if you had high-speed photography, it consists of 3, 4, 5 individual strikes of around 20 microseconds each. There's a whole lot of individual flashes in there. And some of those lightning, a direct lightning flash on average is something like 11,000 amperes for 20 microseconds. So that can do some pretty healthy damage. But if I looked at your installation and looked at all the surrounding property and trees and other things and water towers and whatever that are within a quarter mile of your house, my guess is you're nowhere near as vulnerable as you think you are. But bear in mind that the most perfect lightning protection in the world will protect you from 98% of those lightning strikes, but never 100%. There's no perfect protection on lightning. But you're way ahead of the game as I see it. So if you were standing on your roof and looking around the neighborhood, a block in each direction, I'll bet you there are objects that are taller than you. Although maybe in T-neck you are the tallest thing, Frank. KE2, Kilo Bravo, K2LIW.
Comment and Zuio.
Frank first. Go ahead, Frank.
This is KE2KB. I am almost at the highest point in T-neck. I'm only a couple blocks from the T-neck High School, which I believe is at the highest point. But yes, there are several objects that are higher than my antenna. There's a big pine tree in my neighbor's backyard, and there's a cell tower antenna less than a quarter of a mile from my house that's much, much higher. The utility pole might not be as high as my antenna, so I'm a little concerned, but the utility pole is probably the more likely to get struck. In any case, I've heard of polyphaser. I've been reading a lot about that. Apparently they're superior to Alpha Delta even. But I have an older protector called ICE, I-C-E, and it has a gas discharge tube plus a choke, which chokes only lower frequency noise and not RF. So it drains the actual static charge off the antenna, which might be useful in some cases. But in case of my 2-meter antenna, which is the highest point, it is DC ground, and it's well grounded with this number 4 cable and also a coax cable, which will be run to the same ground point. So I was just concerned about the protected cables running up the side of the house. I was thinking maybe I should put them inside of EMT and ground the EMT. It's a lot of work. But anyway, yeah, I think I agree with you, though. A lot more protection than most people. Most people just run the cable directly in, and that's that. But I do disconnect during storms, before storms. So it's really about fire and safety that I'm concerned, not about the equipment, because I do disconnect everything and then ground the unterminated coax. So, all right, let me, Rich had a comment. This is KE2.
Okay, you're way ahead of what the average guy does. And do you have to go that next step of putting your other cables inside of a piece of conduit? A lot of work. I think it's not required. There's no perfect answer on this. Even if you had all those cables inside of a piece of conduit, and the lightning can still strike the antenna and still put that 11,000 amperes of current through that cable, even though it's inside of a piece of conduit. So even if you go that last mile, it doesn't give you 100%. There's never 100% protection on lightning. That's one of the hard things to accept. Let's see what Rich has got to say about all of the above. N2EO, K2LIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. When I lived in Whitestone, Queens, the very arrested gentleman you're talking about, I had him. Unfortunately, on one antenna that was had been recently put up, I did not have it. I know that antenna got hit by lightning a few weeks after Barry N2MB put it up. Reason I say that, after hearing a loud crash, too close for comfort, yet next morning I saw the antenna burned and sitting in my neighbor's tree. That's pretty hard evidence. Now, I want to say the 8 WRL, which I've just been rejoining, I'm not a member yet, they have insurance, fam gear. I think it's $1.50 per 100, if I'm correct. I don't know if there are any deductibles, but I'm going to find out. Originally, I was theft, not to do with ham radio equipment. I have a tenant here taking care of me, because I'm disabled. I know it was him. I can't prove it. He stole a camera and a brand new school gun. So, I just want to be raw of my ham gear. So I think it behooves all of us to buy the, subscribe to the league and get the insurance. Back to that.
And for some people, that's an approach. And when it comes to lightning striking your equipment, both Rich and Frank, where you, the lay of your land is a very important factor. My grandfather and grandmother had a farm in Port Washington, and every other thunderstorm, lightning would strike one of their barns and gave them an awful lot of grief. They didn't have any lightning protection on the barns. People in those days, this is in the 1920s and 1930s, they didn't know very much about that in those days. So because of that particular hill that their farm was mounted on, lightning would strike their buildings rather frequently. There's probably ways you can find out the lightning striking history for TNEC, for your particular neighborhood, and know whether or not you're vulnerable. It would give you a clue. Lightning, I suspect, 98% of the time, strikes power lines. Let me drop it. You walk up and down your street, and you look at the A, B, and C high voltage phase that's going down every one of those streets, and one of those phases goes to a pole big transformers. They, in turn, feed power into your house. You take a careful look at all of those telephone poles, utility poles going up and down every single street, and they're typically 40, 50, 60 feet high, with three wires for the three phases of 13.2 kilovolts in general. Is the voltage to ground on those three phases on, in many communities. That plus usually a grounded wire that's higher up in the middle of all three. That whole system covers so darn much area up and down every one of those streets. It's a huge attractor to lightning, and lightning will strike it. And therefore, the average ham radio operator, I recommend they use various kinds of surge protectors to make sure that the spike of voltage coming into their 110 to 20 volt line, that's much more likely to give you damage. And that did happen in my neighborhood, for instance. A lightning did strike the power system, and a number of people within a one block area had to, in fact, that's I'm pretty sure what happened in my case when I had damage to my television set and to my modem. So that's a much more likely lightning striking thing. I think you're very well protected, and so if it'll give you, let me drop it. If it'll give you more peace of mind, you could go the next step, but very few hams in your case would do it, and the chances of you being struck are pretty slim, but never perfect. So let us know what you've decided to do in the future, Frank. You've got a, as I said, you're one of the very few hams that I call belt and suspenders. You've gone a lot further than 98% of the hams have gone with lightning and grounding protection. Let's see if there's anyone else that wants to sign in with questions or comments. Give me your call letters and name right now. We're after the beeps. K2RIW listening.
K2J.
Go right ahead, Eric. And there's a guy who's got lightning or attractors like you wouldn't believe. His 300-foot high broadcast tower in one case on Long Island. And he's connected to the Empire State Building, a 1,200-foot high structure that gets struck by lightning probably 30 times per year. Bet you, you've seen some lightning strikes in your time, Eric. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW.
You want SAM?
SAM recognized, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I just wanted to mention something that most people aren't aware of. These gizmos, these little pieces of metal, actually, to come to a very sharp point. They're called air terminals. And what we do as broadcasters, and also on a lot of big buildings and barns and stuff like that, you put a bunch of these air terminals that are connected to ground, and that helps to bleed off the static charges that are getting built, and it's not a guaranteed, well, lightning not strike you, but it is helpful, and there has been a lot of research that shows that it does actually reduce the conditions in which you will get a lightning strike. Even if your air terminals are 100 feet below an antenna, they do seem to be effective. And yes, actually the World Trade Center, the new one, it gets whacked a couple of times already this year. I don't know about Empire, I have to ask one of the other fellas. But the old World Trade Center used to get hit. Oh, I've been up there one night where we got like about 6 or 8 strikes right in a row, and then some more later on. So, you know, it's the tallest thing around, and when the clouds are low enough, it's very attractive to it. But there are things that you can do to mitigate the issues, and as you mentioned, ensuring that your power lines have some kind of spike protector on them. And one of the things that most people aren't aware of, that the spike protectors, the cheap ones that they sell, made of MOVs, and they actually have a failure rate of 2 lightning strikes. They're useless after that. Control RW, K2J.
That's a good point, Eric, that those MOV type things, which is it looks like a very large disc ceramic capacitor with 2 leads coming out of it. They operate by having a spark gap inside, which absorbs the spike, but it gets damaged in the process. So 1 or 2 lightning strikes, and it needs replacement. So the fact that you own an arrestor, and you want to use it for the next 20 years, if you have reason to believe that your system, that your power system has absorbed some strikes, you might want to replace that lightning arrestor periodically to be double-dot sure. And when it comes to a air terminal, any large spiky object that's well grounded, aimed up in the air, it does a beautiful job of discharging the local air slowly. I experienced that one night. Let me drop. I was up my 100-foot tower one evening, and I was noticing that the back of my hair, the back of my head, seemed to be being hit by something periodically. And I also noticed that the tips of the elements on my 432 Yagi at the top of the tower, there was a purple glow across all of those elements at the tips. So there was a high voltage in the area, and it was raising my hair. It was creating this purple glow on the antennas. And so my 432 Yagi was a kind of an air terminal. Obviously, I didn't dwell there very long. I got down real fast. The tower itself has got a bunch of guy wires that are well grounded, so as long as I got below one of the levels of the guy wires, I believed I was reasonably safe. But at the time, I was standing above the upper guy section when I noticed this thing happening. So if you own a Wimshurst machine, one of these machines that can produce 100 kilovolts that'll jump a gap, of a couple of inches when you turn the crank on this thing that's got these 2 great big plates that rotate against each other. It's a static electric machine. And you can study the way high voltage behaves. And those 2 probes you've got in front of a Wimshurst machine, many people don't know that you just set set the 2 probes at a certain gap distance. Well, if you disturb the probes in such a way that one of them is aimed off at a crazy angle far to the right, and the second was aimed at the middle of the rod of that first one, if the one that's pointed at the middle of the other one, if that's the one that has negative voltage on it, you'll notice a light hissing sound as you turn the crank, and it never develops a high voltage and never does a real good spark gap. That's a kind of an air terminal discharge, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. And then you reverse the 2 probes, so that now the left-hand probe, which is the one that had the negative voltage on it, you aim it off to the left at a crazy angle, and the right-hand probe, you aim it to the middle of that rod of the left-hand one, and now you've got positive voltage on the right-hand one. You'll notice that you don't hear that hissing sound as the voltage builds up all of a sudden you hear a nice loud crack when it does discharge. By the way, a Wim Source machine. Sometimes you turn it on, the left-hand side is negative. Sometimes you turn it on, the left-hand side is positive. Whichever way it goes, it keeps going in that particular direction. So it takes some experimenting. But when you experiment with the probes, and don't just send them out there parallel to each other, so to speak, you get some other fancy effects, and you can see the real difference between a negative voltage and a high voltage. So that if that lightning strike coming down to your house happens to be, let me think now, positive, and that is a problem. The cloud itself that's going to give you the local lightning strike, whether it is negative charge or positive charge, makes a real big difference. Let me drop. I'm going to guess that the lightning that happens from cloud to ground, 90% of the time, the cloud, the portion of the cloud that's closest to you, is negatively charged. And that's a normal lightning strike. A small percentage of the time, the portion of the cloud that's closest to you could be positively charged. Those are those super lightning strikes. Those are the ones that give you 50,000 amperes. You can tell the difference because they're extremely loud and much more destructive. So when the cloud is positive, just like the effect you get with the Wim Source machine, it takes a lot more voltage for it to finally discharge. But when it does, boy, is there a lot of energy there. Let me drop. Okay, let's see now. I think it was K1SAM, something blank, Sierra Alpha Mike. Please give us your full call letters and your name and your comments, sir. Mr. SAM, K2RIW, go right ahead.
B2KB, I have another comment.
Yeah, I want to get it in quick while we're still connected. It's KC1 Sierra Alpha Mike, and your name is also Sam. I just want you to know, and Eric will find of interest, that 375 repeater is cutting out. It'll just cut out. Had trouble here, and I wasn't sure you were going to give it to me, but it came back, and I heard you give it to me. So just want to let you know that. I can barely hear the 850. So I just want to pass that along, that there's a problem in there somewhere. Back over to you, Dick, and thanks for picking me up.
Okay, very fine, Sam. You sound good. And right now I'm checking on 975-375, and it's sounding very good right now. Let's hope that it keeps running. Eric's the guy that often does the maintenance on that. He's the guy that does 99% of the maintenance. So, he'll keep track of it, I'm pretty sure. Frank, KE2, Kilo Bravo. Go right ahead, Frank. K2IW.
This is KE2KB. I think my problem is a classic case of too much information. I read the internet. I bought a book from the ARRL. It's a very good book. It's Grounding and Bonding for the Radio Amateur. I bought it on the Kindle, and I read the whole thing, and it points out all kinds of stuff, all National Electrical Code requirements, but it doesn't touch all that much on second floor Radio Shacks. That's why I was, you know, concerned. But this whole thing about lightning, I don't think anything, I'm not going to ever build anything that's going to withstand a direct hit. I mean, I don't have a tower. I just have the dipole up at about, I don't know, 25 feet, and the Ringo Ranger up at about maybe 40, and it's not a situation that's really that prone to
comment.
Okay, this is, anyway, I think it's a classic case of over. What's going on with this radio? This is KE2KB. I'm going to have to.
Yeah, some of the defenses that people consider for lightning, let me drop them, are all kinds of fancy grounding, surge protectors, and so on. And so all of these are a good thing to do. However, if you do have a lightning strike nearby, like say for instance a half a block away, and it gives you a very strong electromagnetic pulse into your system, and it creates some damage, like the worst case damage I can think of is the front end transistor of your radio, the receiver, becomes damaged if it was connected to an antenna, or in some cases the final transistor of the transmitter, your modem can be damaged. The replacement of these things for a guy who is a little bit crafty is nowhere near as expensive as you think. To replace that front-end transistor that got burned up, that may be a $2 part. The final transistor of your transmitter may be a $30 part. Your modem is not a huge cost. So to recover from a lightning strike directly to your antenna or directly to your power line is not the worst thing in the world. It's not the end of the world. With rare exception, those things are fairly repairable without a great big investment, particularly if you've got friends that are crafty with fixing pieces of electronics. Let me drop this. So with the right attitude, we amateurs are not afraid to open up the cabinet and do some troubleshooting on most of the pieces of equipment. As long as you use some reasonable safety procedures, it's not a bad thing to do. There's a certain kind of amateur that's afraid to open up the case for fear that he's voiding the warranty, so to speak. Well, I wouldn't worry about that so much. On top of that, many of the pieces of equipment I've got are many decades old. You're listening to a Kenwood 711A, which is a piece of equipment that was very popular in 1985. So here I am using a 30-year-old piece of electronics. So for me to open up the case to troubleshoot it, I wouldn't hesitate. I wouldn't worry about voiding the warranty. I like this particular rig because it's all mode 2 meters. Sideband FM. It's got the world's best frequency synthesizer. And it's got a completely variable power output. There's when I turn the power up, you'll notice that it doesn't make any hiss. But because people in my house are running other pieces of equipment, I'm running it at the low power level right now, not to give them any grief. Let's see. Wes had a comment. Go right ahead, Wes. K2RIW.
82KB with one more comment.
Okay, Wes first and then Frank in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I think there is a confusion with electrical charge. You imagine that you put on a table a linden jar, and then on a shelf right above, and you charge it, whatever charge. And then you put twice bigger linden jar on the shelf directly above, and then you charge it. And then you put another linden jar on the floor, and you charge it. What would be the difference between the charges in terms of time?
There is a very popular high-voltage static electric generator that you can buy for about $70 if you go to the right website, called a Wimshurst machine. And it's got more than one spelling for Wimshurst. But it was a machine invented in the late 1800s. And so there's a very nice one made that's a Chinese origin, and very well built from my point of view, and it does a nice job. When you turn the crank on it, it's got two Leyden jars, and I'm reasonably sure that you get a positive voltage with reference to ground on the right-hand Leyden jar, and a negative voltage with reference to ground on the left-hand Leyden jar, and you got these two probes from each of those Leyden jars that come out in front of you, and you can adjust the spacing between the two. So, to my knowledge, the machine creates a balanced charge with reference to ground. Although there's ways that you could do some external grounding. And also, the machine itself has got a knife switch between the two Leyden jars, where you can, that normally the grounded terminal of each Leyden jar is normally connected to each other. You can force them to be disconnected from each other by opening up that switch, and you get a very different mode of operation of the machine when you do that. You don't get any great big sparks anymore. You get a hissing sound instead. So maybe this is some of the information you were looking for, Wes. And by the way, if you don't own one of those things, it's a fun machine to play with. Let me drop it. But it's got some peculiar characteristics. On a high humidity day, sometimes the thing has a zero start-up characteristic. You turn the crank and nothing happens. And then, in that case, if you had an ordinary computer monitor or a television set that had a cathode ray tube, and you pick up the Wimshurst machine and put one of the probes touching the glass of your cathode ray tube device, television set or computer monitor, it will pick up a static charge, it'll start the machine running, if you know what I mean. But on a high humidity day, there are times that it's very, very difficult to get the thing to start. But on a dry day, when the wheels are nice and clean, it does a beautiful job. And when the thing is tuned just right, and you adjust the internal brushes in just the right mode, that thing can produce more than 100 kilovolts, probably closer to 200,000 volts it can create. And it's got a very low current capability, so that high voltage is not dangerous, although if it discharges across your hand, it'll make an unpleasant feeling, if you know what I mean. Into XJM, K2IW, good west.
I especially pointed at that because I have a problem with some of the clarity of understanding the phenomena of electrostatic charge. If you have a straight line, in that straight line you have a 3 points, one is ground, one is middle, which is the table, one is shelf. And then on the table you have a twice smaller capacitor that is charged, positively charged, right? And then on the shelf you have a twice bigger capacitor that is positively charged. Don't you think that it would be a natural need to cancel the difference if the charge is strong enough? And to actually...
There's a language barrier here, Wes. I can tell you're talking about a capacitor on the shelf and a capacitor on the table with some kind of a grounding system between the two, and you're asking some kind of a question about what that means and what happens. I'm not understanding enough of the words to know what the question is. I'm back to you, Wes.
Dr. Roy, maybe he would be able to help. He understands me better.
AC2GS, K2RIW. Good luck, Roy.
This is AC2GS. Good evening, gentlemen. I'm not quite sure. The concept is charge is relative to other charges. So you could have a charge that's slightly positive, but to another charge that's extremely positive, that slightly positive charge seems to be negative. But that's the closest I could get to what exactly Wes is trying to get at.
Beautiful. Let me interrupt for a moment. When you did mention the electric strike or the electrical charges, friction may have a upper part of the cloud or atmosphere to be much higher in level of positive charge than that charge that is right below, and that is smaller because the friction was smaller and is also positively charged. And my question was, is it negative towards when it's compared to the higher charge of the same positive sign at upper level? Dr. Roy.
That charge is basically a relative term. So, by comparison, the less positively charged object in comparison to the highly positively charged can be considered to be negatively charged from the relative charge of the highly positively charged. It goes back to everything being relative, unfortunately. And so, its energy is always in relationship to some other thing, whether it's positive or negative. And so I would say yes, you could have a positive charge, but relative to a much more positive charge, it acts as a negative charge.
Beautiful, I agree with that. So then the Dick comment about a positively charged cloud or positively charged part of the atmosphere is a kind of unclear. Maybe I'm thinking, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric. I think the point that Wesley is missing is that nature wants things to be in equilibrium. So you have a bunch of electrons on one side and a whole bunch lot more electrons on the other side, and you would say that the smaller amount of electrons is negatively charged compared to the larger amount of electrons on the positive side. It's a little befuddling to think, but just like one of my transmitters, the cathode is a ground, but the anode is actually the anode is a ground, and the cathode is at minus 30,000 volts, but it's a difference in potential. So, same sort of deal.
I was trying to explain nature of the lightning strike, so I'll take back to you.
Yeah, some of the inside-out transmitting tubes that are used in broadcasts that Eric is familiar with. The anode of the tube is grounded and the cathode is, as he said, negative 30,000 volts. When you and I set up a vacuum tube ordinarily, the cathode is near ground and the anode, we put some high positive voltage on it. So, as far as the electrons inside of the vacuum tube are concerned, as long as the anode is much more positive than the cathode, with relation to each other, then the electrons will flow in the right direction. In the case of lightning between clouds, cloud-to-cloud lightning is much more prevalent than cloud-to-ground lightning. So, on many occasions, the upper portion of a cloud and the lower portion of a cloud have a very different potential, and quite often the lightning strike takes place within the cloud itself. And occasionally there are two adjacent clouds where the upper end and the lower end of the adjacent cloud has a huge potential difference between them. And the crazy way that, hot air rising, creating a convection cell where small droplets of moisture, water vapor, gathering on little particles of dust. Let me drop this. One of the hard things to believe is that when you've got moist air that's about to turn to rain, it needs a nucleation site. It needs something with sharp points for the condensation to begin to happen. The majority of every single drop of rain started off as moisture collecting on a very small particle of dust. So at least in the beginning, before the drops start joining each other, each individual drop of rain has a very small particle of dust in it that initiated the process. Or if those little dusty water vapor modules that are being raised by a hot convection chunk of air, by some process that's not very well understood, as those particles get raised and rub against each other, a charge gets built up. I can't think of the name of the series which where you list all the materials in the world, like glass and wool and polyethylene and whatever. You list all these materials in the right order. It tells you what potential is created when you bring those two materials in contact with each other. Eric, do you know the name of that that series that I'm trying to think of, K2RIW?
Sorry, I guess I do.
Okay, maybe Roy does. What's the name of that series of materials that tell you what charge is built up, electrostatic charge, when the materials come in contact with each other? It's got a man's proper name to it.
Fortunately, I don't know that one. I know electrochemical potentials for different metals for batteries and such, but I don't know that one. And by the way, Lou, NY2H, wants to break in using EchoLink, but no one's giving him enough time.
We're going to give Lou a chance in just a minute. All right, so I'll think of that name, but when you look up this list, once you know the name of it, and you Google that list, and you could also Google probably electrostatic materials and electrostatic generating materials, you'll find out the name of this list, and it's got about 30 items on it. And depending how far apart on the list the two items are when you bring them in contact, for instance, your hair rubbing against a balloon produces a beautiful charge on the balloon, which you can then stick to the wall. Let's go over to Lou, NY2H. We're going to stand by and listen for you, Lou, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'm checking right now. The 975-375 repeater is working. So NY2H, K2RIW. We're standing by for you, Lou. Go right ahead.
Called the Triboelectric Series.
That's it. That's it. Triboelectric Series. Give that man a cigar. So, I guess maybe it's not a man's proper name, Triboelectric. And if you took apart that word, what do you think it really means, Eric? And then we'll stand by for Roy. I mean, for Lou. KE2EJ first. Thank you for that information, Eric.
Yeah, okay, I'm trying to see if I can find out the origin of it. But anyway, Lou, next time type break and it'll announce your call. NY28, go right ahead, K2J.
Fortunately, Lou dropped out of Echo Link, so maybe he'll get back on it. Tribal.